The Hand of Robin Squires, Chapter 16. Only when Actodin was firmly chained to a tree did my uncle let go of my arms. I turned around and faced him. "What will you do with him?" I demanded, my voice trembling with fear and anger. "Put him to work, of course," he laughed, as if my question was the most idiotic in the world. "But he's used to being free," I said. Just then Billy Bowles came up behind my uncle. "If you ask me, this year's one as should be put into chains with the redskin," he growled. "He's nothing but a troublemaker." "There, you see," my uncle said mockingly. "You will have to watch your step, Robin, or Mr. Bowles will clap you in chains as well." "Mark my words," the first mate said sullenly. "This brat is nothing but bad luck. We got no time for the likes of him." "Now, Mr. Bowles," my uncle said lightly, though there was an unmistakable undercurrent of malice in his voice, "I am sure my nephew realizes how important it is that he work with us and not against us. Don't you, Robin?" "And now," he continued smoothly, "I think it is time the first crew was in the tunnel. Our new captive will go with the second string." The first mate grunted and lumbered off toward the ship. I still had to find out what would happen to Actodin. "Will you let him go? I mean afterwards, when the work here is finished?" My uncle started toward the shaft. I followed him. "Well, will you?" I persisted. He did not even bother to turn around, but stood, hands on hips, staring into the pit. And though he spoke, it was in that impatient, offhand way that indicated how little he cared about how I felt. "Don't make a nuisance of yourself, Robin, or I shall have to follow Mr. Bowles' advice and clap you into chains. Now I suggest you make yourself useful. I want the angle of the tunnel and where it surfaces at the cove checked and rechecked immediately. So you had better get the measuring instruments ready." I had been defeated. The helplessness I felt was total. I looked at Actodin. He was leaning against the tree. They had chained both his arms and legs to the thick trunk. Even so, he held his head up. I went to him. "I'm sorry," I said. "I didn't know this would happen. It was stupid of me. I should have come alone." Actodin made no response. He looked through me rather than at me, his eyes dark and unfathomable. "You don't think I wanted this to happen, do you?" I cried. Silence. "Listen carefully," I said, keeping my voice low so the crew members would not hear. "This island is very important to my uncle. When we finish here, he might let you go back to your people." Still no answer. Only that steady gaze, focused somewhere beyond me. "Didn't you understand what I was saying? And if my uncle won't let you go," I whispered fiercely into his ear, "I will set you free. I promise." It was then Actodin turned toward me. "You make trap for me, not my friend. White people lie." He spat these words into my face. "That's not true," I said. "There was no trap. I told no lies." But he would say no more. He had said what he thought, and that was that. I stood there rejected and miserable. Yet I couldn't blame Actodin. He could not have known how much I hated my uncle's treachery. I turned toward him once more. "You may not believe me," I whispered, my voice trembling, "but I will set you free. You'll see." I could not bear to look at his hostile eyes any longer and ran toward the ship, tripping over the brown body of Miko lying on the ground not far from the tree to which Actodin was chained. I had forgotten about the little dog. He ought at least to have a decent burial. Carefully, I lifted the limp body in my arms and carried him toward the shore away from the clearing. When I found a spot where the earth was loose and easily removed, I laid him down and returned to the ship for a shovel. By that time, the sun had risen overhead, burning off the fog that had enclosed us in our ghostly world. Now I saw clearly across the water. Billy Bowles was at the oars of a jolly boat rowing toward the mainland, Actodin's canoe in tow. I could guess what he was doing. He was taking the canoe down the coast where it would be overturned close to shore, scattering the eel pots and skin pouches on the sandy bottom. This ruse was obviously for the day when Actaeon's people came looking for him. They would find the empty canoe, which by then would have drifted nearer their village. Naturally, they would assume Actaeon had drowned and would look for him no more. As far as his people were concerned, Actaeon was dead. When I found a shovel, I returned to the island, dug a deep hole, placing Miko inside, and covered him over. By the time I had finished the sad task, I could scarcely see. The tears would no longer be held back. The loss of my father, Actaeon, and Miko all came together under the heavy specter of my uncle, and I sat by the grave and wept. The end of chapter 16.